Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of space flight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky in July, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's happening in space flight and astronomy then, John?
Hello, Dave. Yes, indeed. Quite a few interesting things to talk about today. One thing that I'd like to start with is absolutely hot off the press, only a few hours old, less than a day old, this news. You'll remember, of course, that there was a tremendous success by NASA with the Cassini spacecraft at Saturn. Now, that, of course, was plunged into Saturn's atmosphere, but there's been absolutely masses of data that is still being studied. So just because the mission is over, the science from Saturn will go on using the Cassini data. Now, they've been looking at the data they gathered relating to Enceladus. Now, that's one of Saturn's four largest, or Galilean, moons. Now, listeners might remember that I've mentioned this before. It's an icy moon. The surface is quite a thick ice crust, but that lays over a subsurface ocean, you know, many, many miles deep. And the crust is cracked in several places, and that's how we discovered the oceans below, because plumes of water from those oceans have been seen coming out of these cracks. Now, what is it that causes these plumes of water? Well, that's thought to be thermal vents at the bottom of the oceans, just like we have thermal vents at the bottom of our oceans, where called black smokers, and life exists there, so people have wondered, well, could these thermal vents be the place where life has started, maybe on Enceladus? Anyway, looking at this data, the scientists have just discovered that within this water it are actually large complex organic molecules. Now, these are believed to have formed on bubbles, on the surface of bubbles, rising, you know, from these thermal vents at the bottom of the oceans. So isothermal vents, in fact. So how did these complex organic molecules get there? Well, one possibility is that it's decaying organic matter. In other words, possibly life. But clearly it's obviously far too early to tell yet. But what it does show is that the possibilities of life, the context or the surrounding possibilities of life are that much better than previously hoped on Enceladus. So we're a little step closer towards discovering whether life exists there. This sort of discovery will put more pressure on NASA for future missions, of how those future missions should be configured, what to look for, you know, when they get there. So, hot news, most interesting news. The other big story out in the solar system at the moment is that there's been a massive dust storm on Mars. Now, we mostly talk about the Curiosity rover, but don't forget that for the last 14 years, there's been Opportunity rover on the surface of Mars. I mean, that's just a wonderful story in its own right, because its life expectancy was only 90 days. And here we are 14 years later, and it's still working, but not anymore. And that's because this massive dust storm has caused it to shut down. Its solar panels are now caked in dust, so it can't get enough power to power it. Curiosity isn't affected because it's not powered by solar panels. It's powered by plutonium, you know, nuclear isotopes, decaying, generating heat. So Opportunity, an old, much older model, you know, is suffering. So that's entered sleep mode. An internal battery that powers a clock, and that clock will wake up the machine to say, have I now got enough power that I can continue operation? And if not, it'll go back to sleep again. So NASA has lost contact with it because it is in that stasis mode at the moment. Of course, if it runs out of power to charge the clock, then that's it, unless winds which exist on the surface of Mars are strong enough to blow the dust off the panels so that those panels can start generating electricity again and warming the spacecraft up, powering it up, and then it will wake itself up, phone back to Earth, phone home, and say, what time is it? Because its clock will have gone, so everything will get reset and it will start to operate again. So that's the hope. As I said, Curiosity isn't affected. Well, it is in a way, in that it sent back a selfie showing, it periodically takes pictures of itself in the context of the Martian surface, and it's absolutely smothered in the dust, the picture, looking at it now. It really is smothered, and the surrounding surface has been infilled. All of the low-lying areas have been infilled by dust. So, as I said, because it's nuclear-powered, in that sense, it's still going. But it's operating under what NASA now calls blood-red skies. Not that much light is getting through, because the dust is suspended high in the very thin atmosphere. And the normal Martian sky, not like our blue skies, because of different constituents, the light is scattered, causing a pale pinkish sky, but that pale pink has now turned into a much brighter reddish colour. Now, these dust storms aren't that uncommon. I've seen one myself many years ago. In fact, that was through Patrick Moore's telescope when I was a wee lad. But that storm is a huge one. It's now bigger than the landmass of the United States and Russia combined. And sometimes these storms can last just a few days, but sometimes they can last for many, many months. As I say, the sand is suspended high in the Martian atmosphere. I read yesterday from some fellow observers that it seems to be settling, and the surface details are now becoming visible again as the dust clouds dissipate. So let's hope opportunity wakes up soon. Okay, let's. Oh, whilst at Mars, not on my InSight mission, but there is another little bit of small news. In the 1960s, two Mariner spacecraft visited Mars, and one of the things that they recorded with their cameras was a surface formation that couldn't be explained at the time. That's called Medusae Fossae. And that's quite a large area. It's about the fifth the size of the United States. But because of the plethora of spacecraft around that have visited Mars since and in orbit around it, and they've been studying this area, they've now explained why this area looks different. It shows that explosive volcanic eruptions spewed out ash and rock nearby about 3 billion years ago when Mars was very young, and together with sufficient greenhouse gases to warm the planet sufficient that water, which would also have been spewed out, probably covered the surface of the planet to a depth of about 4 inches, for a short while until it evaporated again. But that ash has settled back onto the surface and has flowed to low-lying areas and solidified, leaving this porous, low-density sedimentary rocks that are now visible and make up the Medusae Fossae formation. So we still keep learning more and more, and as InSight gets nearer, we'll learn, and lands will learn even more. Okay, let's come back to Earth And, well, coming back to Earth is indeed what three astronauts have just done. On the 3rd of June, half of the International Space Station crew returned, landing as usual in Kazakhstan in a Soyuz capsule. That was one Russian cosmonaut, one American, and the Japanese astronaut as well. So that left two Americans and one Russian up on the ISS, where the full crew is always six. So they were replaced on the 6th of June by a new trio, again launching in a Soyuz, but this includes another European astronaut, a German chap, Alexander Gerst, and that's his second trip to the International Space Station. Ooh, I wonder if he was watching the World Cup. Well, perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned that. Anyway, two American astronauts have also recently made an extravehicular activity, EVA, spacewalk. Their job was to replace a faulty camera, which they did successfully, and a door hatch on an outside experimental door had jammed open, so they've managed to fix that. They've also fitted two new cameras, and these cameras are in the area where the new spacecraft will be docking. When I say new spacecraft, remember that NASA is developing its own module, and I think it's Boeing, if I remember rightly, that have also won the contract together with SpaceX for manned spaceflight, so that America isn't dependent on Russian Soyuz missions for getting crews up and down to and from the space station. Okay, so whilst we're talking about NASA, America in space, need to bring on a little political element. Sorry about this, don't normally do that sort of thing. But there was a recent meeting at the National Space Council, of which Vice President Mike Pence is the chairman. But President Trump attended this Space Council meeting and surprised everybody when he said, "It's don't worry, I'm not going to do an impersonation, but it's not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space." That sounds very Trump, doesn't it? He went on to say, "I'm hereby directing the Department of Defense and the Pentagon to immediately begin the process necessary to establish a space force as the sixth branch of the armed forces. We're going to have the Air Force and we're going to have the Space Force, separate but equal." Now, this idea has been mooted before, but it's actually American military that have always said, no, we don't need it. And that's because the United States Air Force has its own space command, and anything to do with space, and obviously there's lots of military applications in space, it's been down to the USAF Space Command to deal with it. I mean, things like surveillance satellites, but also they've been experimenting with a space plane that's a secret space plane, X-47, if I remember rightly, X-47B, that stays up there and lands again. And nobody knows what it's doing, so presumably this is a military craft. But one bit in his defence is that both the Chinese and the Russians have experimented with anti-satellite capabilities. And if you bring down something like the American GPS system, that would, either by destroying the satellites or blanking them in some way, you know, that would have huge detrimental, not just military effects, but commercial effects as well. We all depend on things like GPS. So I'm sure the Americans do have to counter that kind of threat. So maybe that's what has urged it. Either or it's just because he's been to see the new Star Wars films and thinks we need to have a load of troopers up there. I don't know. Anyway, I've mentioned SpaceX and I've mentioned the USAF Space Command. And SpaceX have just won a nice big contract from the United States Air Force for their Falcon Heavy rocket. We've reported on that. That's successful launch when it launched the Tesla into space. So this is to launch and the contract is $130 million for SpaceX to launch that. And when you compare that to the Delta IV rocket launch for the same satellite proposed by ULA, the United Launch Alliance, their figure was $350 million. So it shows how SpaceX are bringing the cost down of these launches. Of course, one of the ways that they do that is by reuse of spacecraft parts, and in this case it's the booster, and one of those previously flown Falcon 9 boosters has just been tested because that's taking a Dragon resupply vehicle up to the International Space Station in a few weeks' time. So that rocket has successfully passed its test. Now, of course, SpaceX is funded and led by one of these new billionaires, Elon Musk. But, of course, he does have a rival, SpaceX has a rival, and that is Jeff Bezos with his Blue Origin company. Now, SpaceX didn't have any commercial plans for paying passengers. Well, not for suborbital hops, anyway. They were going to send a couple of paying passengers around the moon, but that has been scrapped as they've decided to concentrate on the BFR, the Big Falcon rocket, we hope it stands for. However, Blue Origin are charging ahead with their suborbital plans, and they land their rockets vertically as well, their boosters. So they've announced that their suborbital manned test flight will be soon. What soon means, they wouldn't say. But they have announced that they're going to start selling tickets next year for their suborbital hops. So soon must be, you know, fairly soon then, if they're that confident that they can start selling tickets. And remember, their rocket is called New Shepard, and that's in honour of Alan Shepard, who was the first American astronaut. He didn't go into orbit like Yuri Gagarin did. It was a suborbital hop, and that's what these will be. The capsule is fitted with lots of windows so that the passengers can look out and enjoy seeing the Earth whilst they are weightless in their suborbital hop, and that's going to take 6 passengers in the capsule. So it's quite a big sturdy beast. That will return, of course, under a parachute and land in the desert somewhere with the retro rockets slowing it down just before landing. The booster will have landed vertically for reuse. Now, of course, we've mentioned Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. So in good company, we have Richard Branson with his Virgin Galactic. And you may remember that, of course, they suffered a calamity back in 2014 when it turned out to be pilot error caused their first spaceship to be destroyed and break up in flight. So they've built a second one, and that's called Spaceship 2. It's named the VSS Unity, Virgin Spaceship Unity. So that's had its second powered test. Dropped from the mothercraft and reached a new high for this testing phase, 114,500 feet. So well on the way to getting into space. So that's powered by a hybrid rocket motor. So it's not like a capsule on a booster. This is a space plane that goes up, taken up by a much larger aircraft, and then dropped, fires its rocket. It's the fuel is a rubber-based solid fuel, but also, as I said, it's a hybrid rocket motor burning nitrous oxide. So Richard Branson has said they'll need 2, possibly 3 more test flights before they actually take their first flight into space. So this one will have two pilots, as it's a plane, needs to land back on the an airstrip somewhere, and that will take six passengers. However, because of Richard Branson's way of marketing, they, of course, started selling tickets when it was only just announced that they were starting to develop this idea. And so far, they've got 700 people that have paid at least a deposit. Some have paid the full ticket price, but others have taken the deposits. So things are hotting up in terms of these launches. Let's look much further away now. We've talked in the past, Dave, about exoplanets, and normally these are discovered by transit as a star has a planet passing in front of it. The star's light will dip slightly. And when that is repeated, it's known that it wasn't just an accident, it's a planet on an orbit passing in front of that star, if it's in direct line of sight with Earth. Now, another way has just been tested and found to work. So two different research teams using the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile, in the desert there, have discovered three exoplanets in the what we call a protoplanetary disk surrounding a very young star. Now, when a star forms out of a collapsing cloud of gas, it will start to heat up. The star will eventually fire as fusion starts, but the dust that hasn't made its way into the star will be in a disk surrounding that star, spinning round. And clumps of that gas and particles and dust will start to gather and form into planets. So what these teams have done is studied the movements of the gases within this protoplanetary dust disk surrounding this young star. It's interesting, the star is only a few million years old, whereas our sun is, you know, 4.6 billion years old. But already three planets have started to form, within this dust disk. And they're Jupiter-sized planets. They're quite some way out, 7.5 billion miles, 13 billion and 24 billion miles. That's a long, long way from the primary. But it's believed that planets do migrate, having formed, until they form stable orbits, probably a lot closer. So studying the flows of gas within that dust disk now seems to be another mechanism that we can start to use to discover exoplanets. The tried and trusted way is what the Kepler spacecraft has been using, the minute dip in the sun's light is likened to a moth passing in front of a car's headlights at a distance of umpteen miles. It's that kind of tiny little dip. But the Kepler team, they're still keeping the spacecraft going. It's near the end of its life. It's running out of fuel. They thought its life was over, but they managed to find a way of using its gyroscopes together with a few thrusters to keep it on station. So that has just discovered another 80 exoplanets, candidates for exoplanets, at least. As I say, you do need to confirm it by this happening on a regular basis, so people can say, yes, that's a planet in a set orbit. But although Kepler is near the end of its life, it'll soon be replaced by NASA's TESS mission, Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, I think is what TESS stands for. Whilst we're talking about exoplanets, David, we've mentioned that our very nearest star, which is Proxima Centauri, has at least one planet. But it's thought that it's unlikely to have life on it or to be possible because that red dwarf star that is Alpha Centauri C has violent outbursts of X-rays which would scour the planet of life, that would sterilise the planet. So they've been looking at Alpha Centauri itself. Now, Alpha Centauri is a binary star, a double star, and the Chandra spacecraft has been studying the two components of Alpha Centauri to look for X-rays. And they have said that after this 10-year study, that it's a safe environment, that there wouldn't be sterilising X-rays killing off any life were there to be planets in Alpha Centauri system. We haven't discovered any yet, but obviously because maybe they're there but not in line of sight, so they don't transit and cause a minor eclipse. But clearly it's going to be, you know, once we discover the capability, is going to be a target for investigation. Could we move there? Could life already be there? So at least they know that we'll be safe should we get there, or should there be anyone there already. Elsewhere in our solar system now, European Space Agency, of course, had a wonderful success with the mission to Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And we've talked about this in the past, I hope our listeners will have seen the fantastic images that were sent back. But at the European Space Agency has just released the full set of data, full set of images. So nearly 100,000 images now make up the archive, and that includes the latest ones, which are incredible detail. They include the hunt for Philae, the little lander that went down, but also they've got images from Rosetta's descent onto the surface, you know, where it was finally destroyed. And interestingly, one of those final images has shown the Philae spacecraft. They didn't realise they'd taken a photograph of it, but once they had discovered where it was through these other photos and searching, they found that some of the earlier photographs did in fact show it. And there's just a tiny little leg poking up from behind a rock that is visible. But some of the images, as it came into land, were taken from only about 20 meters above the surface. They're a little bit fuzzy because those cameras were designed to be taking to focus at a much longer distance, but they've processed them as best they can to show the fine detail on the surface. Now, talking about looking at fine detail on the surface, that's a nice segue, wasn't it? We've moved to Ceres, not a planet, but what used to be called an asteroid, the biggest asteroid, and that's now been classed as a dwarf planet along with Pluto. Now, we've had a spacecraft there, NASA has, called Dawn, and that reached Ceres back in March 2015. Now, that's near the end of its life, so they're manoeuvring it to enter its final orbital pattern. Now, you might remember, Dave, that I mentioned last year that what Dawn had discovered on Ceres was a crater with some unexpected, very, very bright white patches in. In fact, there were several of them, but most of them were concentrated in this one crater called Okator. So they need to study this a little bit more. They're believed to be salt deposits, highly reflective. They're bright and white, whereas the rest of the surface is, you know, dullish. So they're bringing the spacecraft down, still in an elliptical orbit, but 10 times closer than it's ever been. It used to be about, at its closest, about 200 miles away, but this is going to get down to 22 miles away. But they've done it in such a way, very cleverly, so that as it's in an elliptical orbit, at, when it gets to its lowest point, Ceres will have rotated so that that crater will be at exactly the same place where the lowest point of the orbit brings it. So in other words, each time it reaches Ceres in its elliptical orbit, it'll be directly above this crater. So they've timed it, synchronized it with the rotation of Ceres very, very cleverly, so that they can study this crater in great detail and these salt deposits. They're going to use gamma ray and neutron spectra to study the surface, and of course, extremely high resolution photography. Now, I've mentioned this confusion about calling something an asteroid. Now it's a dwarf planet. And we've talked about a comet just before, Comet 67P. We do get confused between asteroids and comets. The comets are basically icy. Asteroids are mostly rocky is the distinction. And it's where they originate from is also part of the distinction. But we do have things that look much more like comets within the asteroid belt. So a little bit more research is obviously going to be done by the Japanese spacecraft called Hayabusa. On Tuesday of this week, it has reached its target asteroid called Ryugu. A small one, it's only 900 yards in diameter, and that's 180 million miles away from Earth. And that rotates every 7.5 hours. So Hayabusa 2 was launched from Japan in 2014 and has just got there. So it's going to spend quite a bit of time studying the asteroid to determine the best place to more or less touch down and deploy its instruments. It's going to deploy, first of all, a copper projectile onto the surface. And it's then going to move away, once that is in place, move to a safe distance, because that projectile has an explosive charge on it. So that will fire, driving the impactor deep into the surface, carving out a crater. Hayabusa will then hair back in and to pick up the debris. Debris that's floating in space, it'll sort of sniff out, suck in, so that'll get some particles that way. But then it's going to actually reach into the crater to recover fresh material from within the crater, because the surface of the asteroid will have been bombarded, you know, by solar wind for millions of years, billions of years. So what they want is fresh material from the underneath that surface. So it's going to spend about 18 months studying the asteroid and then return to Earth with the samples in 2020. As I've said, this one is called Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 1 did do this in 2005. It went to the asteroid Itokawa, but it had quite a few setbacks, but did manage to get microscopic samples back to Earth in 2010. But as I said, microscopic, just a few. This one should come back with quite a few grams of material. It's not the only spacecraft out there doing an asteroid sample and return mission. And next month, in fact, the NASA vehicle, OSIRIS-REx, reaches the asteroid Bennu. And that will be, again, returning, coming back with samples. So we'll talk more about that, hopefully, next month. Now, I've mentioned this confusion between asteroid and comet. Remember, Dave, I'm sure I talked about an interstellar visitor, Oumuamua. And when that was discovered, it was thought to be an interstellar comet. But people, scientists decided, well, it can't be, because as it passed the sun, they would have expected to have seen outgassing. Comets from our solar system have massive outgassing. That's why they have these huge comets' tails. But as there was no such tail, it was then classified as an interstellar asteroid. And indeed, they believe it's got quite a chunky crust because of the bombardment from the interstellar medium as it's been wandering through our Milky Way for billions of years. However, scientists have, as they've been able to, as far as they've been able to, have been studying the object on its way out of our solar system. And they've noticed that there are tiny deviations from the course that they would expect. Now, they've calculated that course just based on it being an inert, rocky object, an asteroid. And so knowing the gravitational pull of the sun on it and the various planets that it might be passing, if they're close enough to exerted any pull, and so they've calculated the trajectory just solely based upon that gravitational attraction. But now they found that it's deviated from that, and that can only be explained, they believe, by the fact that it is, after all, a comet, and there has been a little bit of outgassing. So a little bit of outgassing is enough to act like a tiny thruster rocket that we have on our satellites, causing it to change position. So it's the only explanation for it to be moving away from its course is that it is a comet. So it's been reclassified.
Well, I can think of a better explanation, John.
I mean, think what you're going to
we
say.
We know it's an alien tourist spaceship with a cloaking shield to make it look like a lump of rock.
Yeah.
But the pilot isn't that good. You know, the pilot's making minor mistakes as he goes through the exit the solar system.
He's just come out of suspended animation a little bit late. He's just woken up and realised that he's here. And so now he's starting to put the brakes on.
Well, he's probably just having a bit of fun, really. Let's wiggle a spaceship around a bit and see what these Earth people make of it.
You never know.
Asteroids and comets, no chance.
However, closer to home, Dave, an asteroid was discovered heading directly for us on the 2nd of June. And that was quite a discovery, not that it was only that it was just coming directly for us, but it was about 250,000 miles away when it was discovered. And given that it's only 2 metres across, that was remarkably good observing to have discovered that. It was discovered by in America, at Tucson, by the Catalina Sky Survey that looks for this sort of thing. So they passed that data on. Clearly, it would impact with Earth, and so that could have caused problems. And indeed, its trajectory was confirmed by other scientific institutions. So only a few hours after discovery, it did enter our atmosphere. But travelling at that sort of speed, 38,000 miles an hour, when you hit our atmosphere, it's straight on. It's like hitting a brick wall. So it broke up. They expected it to break up over South Africa, and indeed that's exactly where it did break up. So it shows that they're getting better. It was actually recorded on a webcam at a farm. You can see this huge fireball as it came in. So no doubt people will be hunting now for chunks of this asteroid, if any parts survived the fiery breakup and re-entry. But it does bring home to us, you know, our vulnerability. And it's very timely, because Asteroid Day, which is a new event, it was, I think the first one was last year, or the first one that I'd heard about was last year. Asteroid Day happens again this year on the 29th and 30th of June. So we need to find these asteroids before they find us. That's their sort of theme. So listeners might be interested in getting on the web. There's going to be a 48 hours broadcast from Asteroid Day. Brian Cox is presenting it. They're going to have astronauts taking part, all sorts of scientists, researchers. The website, if anybody would like to watch this, is asteroidday.org. So do two D's there, asteroidday.org. No hyphens, no full stops, or well, apart from the .org. And you'll see live broadcasts, which will then be repeated, but lots of interesting discussions. Brian May is part of the organisation. Whether he's playing or not, I don't know, but he has, of course, a PhD in solar system matters, the interplanetary dust, the solar dust that exists within the solar system. So that's it, Dave. Quite a lot to get through there. These 10 minutes will have been useful to help cover, but extras will be in the podcast.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating update. You did cover a lot of stuff today.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So, John, what is the constellation of the month then?
Our constellation this month, David, is Hercules. It's quite a large constellation, but not one of the brightest or well-known ones. Most of the stars are only about third magnitude. But it's well worth finding because it contains two absolutely fantastic objects, globular clusters, M13 and M92. So the slides showing where to find it and what these things look like can be found, of course, embedded within my WhatsApp slides in the PDF downloadable from the website.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
So what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month then, John?
Well, as the nights start to get a little bit darker, of course there's not much darkness around at the moment, but they will be able to find quite a few planets in the evening sky. We've got Venus, that even through the late twilights we get now, Venus is very high and dominant in the west. But in the southwest we've got Jupiter, south to southwest, depending when the sun goes down, we've got Jupiter. Saturn is coming up, and later in the evening, Mars. But in terms of the constellations, my constellation of the month last month, Bootis, is nice and high, and in fact Hercules is close to that. The summer triangle is a good thing to try and learn, because that helps you to navigate your way around the night sky. That's made up of the three bright stars of Vega in the constellation Lyra, Altair in the constellation of Aquila, the eagle, and then in Cygnus, the swan, we have Deneb. So those three stars together make up the summer triangle. Pegasus is coming up in the east as well, and so that means that nearby Andromeda, with the great nebula, the galaxy M31, will also start to become visible. So some good observing to be done towards the end of July, particularly as the night starts to get a little bit darker, and for the rest of the year. In terms of moon, best time for looking at the moon, I would say, would be around the 19th at the first quarter. Or, if you're up early, the third quarter on the 5th in the morning. Full moon is on the 27th. New moon, best for dark sky observing, is on the 12th. So Mercury is also visible at the start of July, but it's very, very low, only 5 degrees high in the west-northwest. But it'll dim by mid-month, and we'll lose it then. But it'll be back in August as a morning object. Talk about that then. Venus, I've already said, really, really bright. Magnitude -4. You can't miss it. Big bright spark in the west and the west-northwest, setting about a couple of hours after the sun. Mars is approaching opposition, that is, its closest. And this year it's going to be the biggest and brightest that it has been for over a decade. That's just because of the coincidence of its orbit and our orbits are both elliptical, and its closest to the sun and our furthest from the sun are coinciding as it's getting close to us. So it's actually going to be brighter than Jupiter at magnitude -2.8. But still, sadly, relatively low, only 11 degrees high in the south. But it's going to be visible for the next several months. Jupiter, a nice bright object, mag -2.1, is there in the south-southwest as night falls. About the same kind of elevation, 11 degrees. So sadly for me, that means below neighbours' houses and trees and things like that, unless I take the scope somewhere else. Saturn, an evening object, low in the southern sky, but much fainter than Jupiter, Mars and Venus, at mag 0.4. But its rings are nicely tilted towards us. So even in binoculars, if you find your way to it, you'll see it as an oval rather than a circle. Those are the rings, but the telescope will show you it as rings. The two telescopic planets, not really visible to the naked eye, Uranus and Neptune, both become visible again as morning objects this month. But you do need a good piece of astronomical software or a star map to show you where to find them. Stellarium is perhaps the best known of the planetarium programs, and it's a free download. Events of interest to help you to find these planets, on the grounds that everybody can find the moon. The moon will be near Mars on the 1st, just 4 degrees apart in the early hours. Mercury, if you can find your way to that on the 2nd, is passing by one of the Messier clusters, M44, Praesepe, or better, sometimes known as the Beehive Cluster. Venus will be close to another bright star, Regulus, the prime star of Leo, just a degree apart. So that might make an interesting sight on the 8th. Mercury will be near the moon. That's going to be quite a challenge because the moon will be very, very thin and slender, only 4% lit, just after sunset on the 14th of July. The moon and Jupiter, 4 degrees apart on the 20th. On 27th, here's something for you. Total eclipse of the moon. But sadly, the eclipse will already be underway when the moon rises at 9:10 summer time. So it'll be not a completely dark moon, as you might expect. It's a coppery colour, and that's because the sun's light is refracted around the Earth onto the moon. So although the moon is completely in the shadow, and so therefore should be dark, it'll be lit by a ring of light around the, as seen from the moon, the Earth's atmosphere. So that lasts from 9:10 until about 20 to midnight. The total phase will finish and go into partial phase. If any of you have telescopes and are looking at the moon on the 28th and 29th, don't think you've discovered an extra moon. It just happens to be that the four moons that are of about the same brightness will be joined by a background star. of the similar magnitude as Jupiter is passing in front of that star. So it will look as though there are five moons. And we have known people think, oh, there's an extra moon. So don't make that mistake. Now, let's talk about some meetings at astronomical societies. Oh, one thing I should say before I do that. Don't forget, all the way through July, to look for these noctilucent clouds. They're starting to be seen, and they can be quite magnificent. So look for them in the northwest to north. They're clouds of ice particles exceedingly high in the atmosphere that are lit by the sun, which is by now below the horizon. But because these are exceedingly high, the sun's rays are still catching them. These are often seeded, as I think I mentioned last month, by meteor trails in the upper atmosphere. I would normally point you to a meeting at Guildford Astronomical Society, but it's the AGM on the 12th, and so that's members only. Farnham, our nearest other astronomical society, have a meeting on the Tuesday, the 10th of July, with two of their own speakers. First of all, American Astronomy Before Columbus by Mark Rumsby, and then Rory Fenner is talking about Clash of the Titans after that. So that's at Aldershot Cricket Club. Croydon Astronomical Society, who meet at Royal Russell School, have two meetings. I don't know the title of the one on the 6th of July, but on the 13th of July, it's Professor Andrew Coates, an excellent speaker from Mallard Space Science Laboratory at Holbury St Mary, talking about ExoMars, the European Space Agency's mission to Mars with a lander coming up. I think it's 2020 now is the expected launch date. There is also a talk at Yule Astronomical Society by the gentleman who used to run Astronomia, the telescope shop in Dorking that some people will remember. So that's Neil Phillipson. I don't know the title of his talk, which is on the 13th of July at Nonsuch High School for Girls for Yule Astronomical Society. So that leaves us just one bit of armchair astronomy, the sky at night, watching the television, which is on the 8th of July, repeat the Sunday, repeat at 10 o'clock, repeated on Thursday the 12th at 7:30, Thursday, and it's called Outback Astronomy. Earlier this year, news broke that astronomers had seen the cosmic dawn, that is, the moment the first stars formed. Chris Lintott travels to the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory to find out how the discovery was made and what else these extraordinary telescopes can tell us about the universe. So that's it, Dave. My predictions for the coming month.
Thank you very much, John, for the fascinating insights. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. Podcast will also have more items that we couldn't quite fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday, 27th of July. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dave.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.